Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, religion scholars Reza Aslan and Alan Stefans sit down with Emily D. Cruz to discuss their new anthology, A Nation Wrestles with God, American Prophets, Philosophers, and Firebrands. This book and conversation are presented in conjunction with the American Writers Museum's special exhibit, American Prophets, Writers, Religion, and Culture, of which Stefans and Cruz were advisors. American Prophets is now on display at the AWM. This program was part of the 2026 American Writers Festival, co-hosted by the American Writers Museum and the Chicago Public Library. The American Writers Festival is a free literary event featuring in-depth conversations with diverse writers from across genres and backgrounds. This conversation took place June 7th, 2026, and was recorded live at the Harold Washington Library Center. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
Thank you for all being here today. I want to welcome you to our third American Writers Festival. I'm Kerry Cranston, president of the American Writers Museum. We're thrilled to partner with the Chicago Public Library to present to the city of Chicago this free event with close to 100 writers, including nationally renowned and award-winning authors, screenwriters, poets, podcasters, influencers, and playwrights. These writers have come from all across the country to talk about books, poems, plays, and films. Today, you'll hear about experimental audio dramas, masterful short stories, music journalism, and dozens of other ways writing enriches our history, our culture, and our daily lives. This festival wouldn't be possible without our generous sponsors, our presenting sponsors, Brenda and James Grisecki, made today a reality, as did lead sponsorship from the Poetry Foundation and Sourcebooks. We'd also like to thank Joan and Robert Clifford, Ivan and Kathy Kane, and Totally Booked with Zibby for their support. I want to thank all of you for being here, for valuing the past, especially the present, and the future of American writing. And I want to introduce our first program. Our first program here today in the Pritzker Auditorium celebrates the museum's major initiative this year about writing and religion. American Prophets, Writers, Religion, and Culture is an exhibit that opened last year, and we encourage you to come visit it at the museum. As a part of that initiative, a new anthology, A Nation Wrestles with God. Editor Alain Stefans and contributor Reza Aslan examined hundreds of years of writers encountering the divine and defining meaning, belief, and spiritual truth. Alain and Reza will be joined today by Emily Cruz, executive director of the Martin Marty Center, at the University of Chicago Divinity School. Please join me in welcoming them to the stage.
Hello, everyone. Thank you all for being here. I am delighted to hold this conversation about, would you hold up that volume for us? This excellent volume, A Nation Wrestles with God. It is the companion to an exhibition on which Ilan and I were consultants and a number of other Chicago-based folks that is now open at the American Writers Museum, so you can go and see it for yourself. That's American Prophets that Kerry mentioned just a minute ago. I apologize in advance for the wretched state of my voice, which is due to a really mean cold that has turned into this sound. So if I fall asleep or say something wild, we'll blame it on the cold medicine, okay? I would like to begin by offering each of you a chance just to say who you are and tell us a bit about your work, but especially as it has to do with religion and writing or religion and writing together.
Hello, everybody. So lovely to see you all here in this gorgeous Chicago day, one of seven I think you get, right? So I'm glad to be here for it.
At least nine, at least.
My name is Reza Aslan. I am a scholar of religions and a writer. I guess for me, my interest is primarily in the intersection of religion and identity and everything that that entails, be it politics or racism or politics or race or ethnicity or social status and the way that those things affect religious experience. And I think partly that has to do with my childhood. I grew up in Iran. I was the child of a, we were sort of basically moderate Muslim family. Islam was part of our culture, the way religion is so much a part of everyone's culture, except for my father, who was a communist and a diehard atheist, and like a problematic atheist, not like the nice kind of atheist, you know? I always say the kind of atheist who had a pocket full of Prophet Muhammad jokes that he would pull out at inappropriate times, like that kind of atheist. And when I was 7 years old, there was a revolution in Iran, a revolution that ultimately resulted in us having to flee the country and come to the U.S. But I think that experience of revolutionary Iran really seared into my mind the power that religion has to transform a society for good or for bad. And I think that's just sort of never left me. It's been a part of my writing and my academic work. And you know, it's a good thing too, because it turns out that this interplay of religion and politics hasn't actually gone away. It just keeps getting more and more problematic. So fortunately, I keep finding jobs, which is nice.
Thank you, Reza. And thank you, Emily, for doing this. I am Ilan Stavans. I am an immigrant from Mexico, a descendant of Eastern European Yiddish-speaking Jews who intended to come to the United States. At least 3 out of 4 of them put immigration quotas at different times in the teens and 20s, made it impossible, and depending on the grandparent, they were stationed in the Caribbean or in Central America and eventually made it to Mexico. On my father's side, I come from an absolute secular actor who did a lot of, who was very well known in Mexico for doing soap operas very prominently. On my mother's side, I come from a line of Orthodox Jews who were committed mainly to the mystical aspect of Judaism, the Hasidic aspect, in the 19th century, in the 20th century. My mother, however, eloped with my father and eloped with his ideas and rejected and resisted religion, only to find out later on that religion was an integral part of her soul, and continuously read mystical and religious texts and introduced me as a young man to them. I came in 1985 to this country with a dream of becoming a writer and a scholar, and the dream of living in a society that was going to be kind and gentle to others, only to find out maybe 35 years ago that kindness has been turned upside down, and that now immigrants are the ones that are the most vulnerable in this society. And I take that truly at heart, because I went through very similar experiences. I am a scholar of culture in general, very interested in religion, in a variety of religions, and I am also a translator and a poet and an essayist, and a publisher of the publishing house, nonprofit, independent, called Restless Books, that published this volume as a companion, as Emily was saying, to the exhibit. And it compiles 400 years of American writers wrestling with God in different ways. And one of the fascinating aspects of that I discovered in the process of putting the book together is that every generation of American writers, even before the independence, and certainly including Native Americans and blacks, have come up with their own view of what God is or isn't, that changes. We don't like to think of God as changing, but that is one of the features that seems to be recurrent. The transcendentalists had a view of God, Whitman and Emerson and Thoreau, different to the, I'm just throwing here, periods of the civil rights era, who saw the Reverend Martin Luther King and Malcolm X, different views of what God is or shouldn't be. And just to conclude this part, and I'll really stop here, I want to read a very short piece from the anthology by the only non-American, but probably an honorary American in the volume. It is by Tocqueville, Alexis de Tocqueville. And this is a French man who in the 19th century traveled around the United States to see the prison system and ended up writing about how democracy survives here. It would have been interesting to have Tocqueville in the 21st century and see if the democracy indeed survives. And this is a quote that comes from his book, The Old Regime and the French Revolution. I have sometimes asked Americans whom I chance to meet in their own country or in Europe whether, in their opinion, religion contributes to the stability of the state and the maintenance of laws and or of law and order. They always answered, without a moment's hesitation, that a civilized community, especially one that enjoys the benefits of freedom, cannot exist without religion. In fact, an American sees in religion the surest guarantee of the stability of the state and the safety of individuals. Back to you, Emily.
That's a spicy place on which to end your comments, maybe. Let's talk a bit about the volume and what you intended as editor and publisher. So well done managing all parts of that process. And Reza has a piece in the volume. So Ilan, why don't you tell us a bit about how you made the selections, how you understand the volume to connect to the exhibition, maybe a bit about your introduction, and then we'll hear from Reza about the piece he contributed.
Great. And I can't wait to hear that part. To me, an anthology is a portable library. It's the capacity to reduce into one book the essential texts that really live in a library such as this temple, but that the editor selects and allows to talk to one another in ways that I think only when the libraries like this one are closed do books really communicate without the presence of us being in front of them. So how does Emily Dickinson talk to James Baldwin or the author of The Wizard of Oz talk to Tony Kushner, the playwright, or any other writer in America that has been wrestling with the question of God? When you enter the topic, you find out that in one way or another, even the atheists, like you were talking about your father, are constantly wrestling with God, with the absence of God, or with the resistance of God, or with the denial of God. And that center keeps on being pushed in different directions. So what I wanted in the volume is to, first of all, produce a love letter from me as an immigrant to this country. I feel very grateful for what the country has given me all these years, and offer a slice of what an immigrant sees in the American discussion on religion, and to highlight the fact that ultimately, it's these writers and politicians. The volume includes political figures and teachers and mystics and people that connect themselves to yoga, television, all kinds of other things, wrestle with the question of God. And the act of wrestling is ultimately, to me, probably the most distilled form of prayer, the one that shows you that one's own relationship with God is never static. It's always being transformed, and that we might have different gods, but do very similar things when we have different gods. And one of the questions that the book asks is, when we pray to God and we think that God is omniscient and omnipotent and ubiquitous, if that is the case, does every religion have a different God, the Jews and the Christians, the Muslims, or are we all praying to one single God that has an exclusive relationship with every exclusive group? Or are we praying to a variety of gods depending on where they come from, where the individual comes from? I find the book to be an attempt to respond in the voices of the people to this very large question of, are we exceptional in America? And what does it mean that the second paragraph of the Declaration of Independence says that we are endowed by their creator? In what way are we endowed that other nations like Mexico or Iran are not endowed? Is God American-prone? American supported. And I think the recent debate between the Pope and this administration in some ways gives you a taste of how we exclusivize God. But to you, Reza.
Yeah, that was an excellent description of the volume. My chapter is very short, and it essentially begins by providing a different kind of analysis to the Adam and Eve story. If you're not familiar, the book of Genesis has actually two creation stories, Genesis 1 and Genesis 2. They're two contradictory creation stories written by two different hands and probably something like 500-600 years apart from each other. But this, the one that we're most familiar with is the Adam and Eve story, which is in Genesis chapter 2. And you all kind of know this story a little bit, right? So God creates Adam and Eve, and he puts them in the garden, and he says, you can eat of any tree that you want, except for one tree. You cannot eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Because if you eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, you will die. And then the serpent shows up. And I know in like traditional Christian theology, the serpent is the devil. He is not the devil. The serpent is never described or identified as the devil. From Genesis to Revelation, the serpent is never called the devil. That's an extra biblical material. The testimony of Adam and Eve is the text in which he's first referred to as the devil in disguise. He's just a serpent. He's the craftiest of the animals. And he says to Eve, and then I love this part, because we always read past it. And Adam, who was with her. I mean, we skip that part, right? It's always like Eve does something wrong. It literally says, and Adam, who was with her. And basically the serpent says, why don't you eat from this fruit of this tree? And Eve says, God told us that if we eat from the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, we will die. And the serpent says, what? No, you won't die. You'll just have knowledge, and with knowledge, you will be like God. And so they eat of the fruit. And guess what? They don't die. And guess what? They suddenly attain knowledge. And it turns out that God is a liar. Just flat out lied to these two. And the serpent was telling the truth. And then what happens next? God freaks out. He tells his heavenly host, whoever is with him, he's always speaking in the plural. He says, oh no, they ate from the knowledge of good and evil. And they found out that I was lying. And now we have to kick them out of the garden. Why? Why do they have to kick them out of the garden? We all think it's because disobedience. But that's not what God actually says. God says we have to kick them out of the garden in case they eat of the fruit of the tree of life. Then this way, they'll live forever, and they will be gods. And I read that now, like as an adult. Like I read it as a kid, obviously read it in a completely different way. Read it as an adult, and I'm like, what is this story? This is a very odd story. And when sort of placed within this kind of larger, though admittedly hazy knowledge that we have, or that we can reconstruct about the earliest forms of spirituality, what we would refer to as paleo spirituality. So we're talking the earliest Homo sapiens, we have access to them based on their material evidence. It's not that hard. But even before Homo sapiens, like Neanderthals and Cro-Magnon, like, can we access their spirituality based on the material evidence that they left behind. The consensus is that the first expression of anything that we can call religion was a form of what we nowadays have labeled animism. And what is animism? Animism, which still is a belief, still exists, it is the belief that all things are animated by a spirit. And when I say all things, I don't mean like all people and all trees. I mean this table. I mean this chair. That if a thing exists, it exists only insofar as it shares in the existence of the only thing that exists, which is Creator. And so therefore, as pantheists like to say, all is God and God is all. And so I go back to that first story of Adam and Eve, and I kind of reinterpret that story based on kind of what we know about that ancient form of spiritualism. And it really changes the nature of the story. It changes the actors in the story, and it becomes a story of that notion, that first form of spirituality being interrupted, being sort of, being conflicted and turned into something else, a different form of spirituality, one in which the divine nature exists only in one place, only in one being, instead of in all places and in all things. So that's my contribution of it.
Okay, so we've got lots of gods just between your two stories. One God, multiple gods, American God or American loving God, preferential treatment God, heavenly host having, fruit hoarding, knowledge hoarding God. Just alone from your, you know, from your two comments, we have a sense that there's no single strand here, either from the way the two of you talk, but potentially from the volume either. And so I'm curious about if you had to try to narrow the way the volume writes about American religion and the way the pieces that are included narrate an American religion or American religions, plural, what does that look like? What is American religion?
I think, Emily, that American religion, just as is the case of American life and American culture, is a sum or an addition of parts. A country that has every single language in the world existing in our cities, every single individual coming from another part of the globe, cannot but have a plurality of reactions and relationships with the divine. And even though we talk about assimilation, and maybe when we talk about assimilation, we talk about the desire to enter a stream where we all share certain notions. I think religion is a rather ample and multifaceted dimension that enables Americans to keep their own religion and still assimilate to the larger mainstream or the larger current. One of the things that we have as a law in this country, and so far it's being respected, even though there's always the tendency of supremacy of one religion vis-a-vis the others, is that the religion of the individuals is private and should be left to them to decide. There is inevitably, in a society of 335, 40 million people, the tendency of one group saying, I will tell you that my God is superior to yours. But it is in the friction, it is in the tension of the diversity, of the multiplicity, that we are best as a nation. And I think that it is in that tension that we are also best in the dialogue with religion. It's not only that we are coexisting with others that have different views of religion, but the view of Judaism in 250 years has changed in this country. And in the book, there is Abraham Joshua Heschel, who walked with the Reverend Martin Luther King in Selma Alabama, who said it's not only that man, or at that time that was the word that was used, is searching for God, but using a very mystical view, he said, actually God searches for man. God is alone and lonely, and it is dependent on the other side of the relationship. And that is a very, that's a Middle Ages concept of, can you transform God through liturgy? Can you make God cry through your prayer, rather than simply receiving the mighty power of God and reacting as a puppet? And so I think each of our own views is coexisting with others, and we're also historically being transformed by the forces of that tradition as they have interacted with other forces.
Yeah, I think Ilan is absolutely right. This is the most religiously diverse nation on earth, by which we mean pretty much every religion that exists in any significant way has a foothold here in the United States. That has obviously a lot to do with the fact that we are a nation of immigrants, and that's how we form our identity. That's absolutely true. And it's also absolutely true that if we were to discuss what is the fundamental nature of American religion, it's individualism, which is important to understand, conflicts with a lot of religious traditions, which are not individualistic, but communal. That is true of Judaism, of Islam, of Catholicism. Most religions are about your identity as part of a collective. That's where you find your salvation, if you will. In fact, I had a professor who once told me as a joke, but it's kind of true, that no matter what religion you are in America, you're more or less Protestant. Like, you know, whatever, you're basically Protestant. And there's a truth to that. The Protestant mentality, when we talk about assimilation, like you just said, that all these religions assimilate into American culture, well, what we mean is they become more Protestant. That's what we mean by that. And that's, you know, not necessarily an accident. I mean, we do rightly celebrate the fact that our founding documents guarantee the freedom of religion to our citizens. But I mean, come on, you guys are, come on. The founding fathers didn't mean religious pluralism. They meant Protestant pluralism. They meant this is a country where you could be Methodist, you could be Episcopalian, I mean, you could be all of those Baptists. But they didn't mean Catholics. They certainly didn't mean Jews, even though Jews came here with Columbus. They certainly didn't mean Muslims, even though Muslims came here on slave ships before there was anything called America. That's not what they meant. And the story of religious diversity in America isn't a story that begins with this incredible founding document that then gave freedom to all these different religious communities who came here looking for security and the opportunity to worship as they please. The story of America is this promise, vaguely defined but still set in stone, and then community after community coming in and fighting, sometimes to the death, for the rights that they were already given. That's the story of religious pluralism. And you, if you're talking about Catholics or Muslims or Jews or the Chinese or indigenous religious traditions, that is how that you tell the story of America's religious diversity in a proper way. Not that it was a thing handed down from the top, but a thing that every single minority religious community had to fight and struggle for, sometimes quite violently, in order to actually receive the thing that they were promised in the first place.
And I think that narrative shows up very nicely in the text and in what's chosen here, because yes, we do see some very conventional writers and thinkers who people might say, oh, yeah, of course, they represent American religion, which means they represent a particular kind of theologically oriented American Protestantism. But then we have lots of other kinds of writers and thinkers and comedians and musicians, filmmakers who have a very different kind of perspective that sort of is part of banging their heads against that, you know, not fixed in stone, but in stone. I wonder if you could talk a bit about some of those writers. Who are the ones who offer the contradiction to the narrative of high Protestantism?
Excellent, Emily. Well, maybe as a starter, I will mention a relatively recent, 2 or 3 years old, Pew Research survey that established that though a affiliation by Americans to churches and synagogues and mosques is down, certainly in the next generation, spirituality in America is up and manifests itself in all kinds of ways. It can be simply as a way of relating to the world, not through an official individual who's a priest or a rabbi or a dervish or what have you, but through the excitement, the exhilaration, the ecstatic transformation that might simply entail consuming drugs or relating to somebody else that is new in a relationship. I think that's very important because I see my students, I teach 18 to 22s who can be very skeptical about religion but are not skeptical about spirituality. The other part that I wanted also to mention now in direct reaction to what you were saying, Emily, is that it could be false to suggest that what Walt Whitman was thinking in the middle of the 19th century, or Baldwin, James Baldwin in the middle of the 20th century, is what all Americans are thinking at that time. False. They are just the ones that become vocal, articulate, and engage others in those views. And yet it is ultimately the ones that leave some kind of testimony, a new gospel, a poem, a short story, Flannery O'Connor or Isaac Bashevis Zinger, that ultimately lead you to think that other people were probably doing the same. And I'm thinking just with a transcendentalist for a second. It was Emerson, one of the greatest intellectuals in this country, who was with Thoreau, his protege, fascinated with Buddhism in Hinduism, the very first time that both currents were entering American society, that began to engage with pantheism, with a vision of a God that is everywhere, all of us, nature itself, and that is the Emersonian view. Nature itself is where God is, and this is nature, and this is nature, and this is nature too. And that concept, again, there's very often a repetition or recycling of concepts. Spinoza had already come up with that idea. Spinoza, one of the greatest rebels of religion, who was pushed out in Amsterdam by the Jewish community because he was too anti-Bible, as Reza was saying, is actually the one who argues that it is the mind, the way we articulate the vision of the world, where God manifests itself more purely and more directly, that the world is an intelligent mechanism into which we fit. And that will be carried over to the 19th century in America with Emerson and Thoreau and Dickinson and Hawthorne and Whitman as a view of this unitarian force that can encapsulate all other visions. But what you're leaving behind there, and many of them were appalled by slavery. Thoreau, now it's pronounced Thoreau, was very concerned that the founding fathers had committed the original sin. They had transformed humans into slaves and thus taken a divine act of subduing and reducing to a non-human capacity slaves. And that actually doesn't even begin to address the issue of what was happening with all the Native Americans at that time, a topic that Thoreau is not really interested in, and even less so Emerson. But it is through those visions, through the speech that Emerson gives at the Harvard Divinity School, through Walden by Thoreau, that you can get a taste of how that God is actually being defined by the books that are arriving from the East and how it's being adapted to this American experiment on religion.
Anything you want to add?
That was brilliantly put. I do want to slow down on one thing that Ilan said, but I think it's super important, and it's vital that we actually analyze these data points, because I think sometimes we miss the point. And you've seen probably the headline saying that, you know, America is becoming less religious at an incredible rate, and the percentage of Christians in America is falling off a cliff. And that atheism is on the rise in America. Those are all kind of true, but misleading. The Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life that Ilan mentioned has for decades been tracking American spirituality, so we have decades and decades of data on this. It's really fantastic. And it is true that the percentage of Americans who identify as Christian has dropped precipitously. It's dropped from 79% to 72%. So that's still 7 out of 10 Americans who call themselves Christian. And it is true that the percentage of atheists has risen steeply over that same period. It now rests at about 2.5%. So yeah, it's gotten much higher than it was. And I think atheists, not incorrectly, will say that number's a lot higher. People just don't want to say, even on an anonymous form. But that's the most fascinating thing that's happening in American spirituality. It doesn't have to do with the 8% loss of Christians or the doubling of atheists. It's precisely what Ilan was talking about, which is a new category that the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life had to invent. Because you've probably have even seen these. You get this little thing in the mail, you open it up, and it's got all the religions, and you just bubble in the one that's you. And then you put it back in the envelope and send it off. Well, for decades, that worked just fine. And then it stopped working, because people would look at this and say, I'm none of these. You can choose agnostic, you can choose atheist among the list, and people were just not choosing anything on here. I'm none of these things at all. And so somebody very clever at Pew added an extra bubble, non-affiliated. Just an opportunity for people to say, I'm neither of these things, I'm not atheist, I'm not even agnostic, I'm just non-affiliated. Why do we talk about this? Like religion nerds like us, we get so crazy about this because that number has been exploding. And in 2025, it was 24% of all Americans, a quarter of all Americans chose non-affiliated. That's astonishing. It's like a snapshot into the changing religious landscape of this, the most religious and most religiously diverse country in the world. And we're not really in a place yet where we can truly interpret that data in any real meaningful way. We need at least another decade to make sense of it. But there are people who have begun to crunch these numbers, and I do think that some of the interpretation is important. Number one, when you ask those people, the 24%, they're essentially spiritual but not religious. That's not what the category is, but that's basically what they're saying. When you ask them about their spirituality, yes, they talk about the things that they do. Yoga is where I get my spirituality from, or, you know, climbing mountains or hiking is where I get my spirituality from, etc., etc. But then when you ask them theological questions, okay, well, how would you define God? They immediately revert to traditional religious language and the traditional religious language of the religion that they grew up in, right? So if you grew up Christian and now you're just not that anymore, but you still are a believer and you're asked, okay, that's great. So how to describe God to me? You'll say, God is love. You grew up Muslim and they'll say, well, describe God. And you'll say, God is justice. So again, if anybody out there is looking for a dissertation, by the way, this is the time. We don't really know exactly how to make a definitive judgment about what is happening in America in spirituality, but the data is really, really fascinating.
Just as a note, I run a research center that focuses on religion at University of Chicago, and we recently hosted the religion guy from Pew, so the one who fields all those surveys and helps write all those questions, et cetera. And he said to the audience, if you get one of those forms in the mail, please fill it out. Don't do what everyone else does and go, meh. So I feel like I'm doing my good deed for the day and passing on to you. Please fill out that survey. And then you could put a note, Emily Cruz says to fill this out. So that
you get a dollar?
Yeah. Or at least I get some credit for my labor. We have about 5 minutes left, so I want to ask, I think something that I really appreciate about this book and appreciate about the way you two have spoken is that it does sort of two things. On the one hand, it says, even if you don't like it, or even if, you know, and because you love it, religion has played and will continue to play probably a significant role in American culture. That what that role is might change, but it's probably not going away. But on the other hand, how we talk and think about religion is more complicated than we often give it credit for at sort of first glance. So we assume we know what religion is, we assume we can define it without effort, but then we see actually there's so much complexity and diversity that the conversations are much harder than we think. So I'm wondering if you could draw on your own work, on your own writing as, you know, widely published writers and television personalities and owners of publishing companies, et cetera. How do you think about the relationship between those two things? Persistence in some form and complexity or diversity?
That is what is so interesting about this country, that persistence, perseverance in the fact that it's a restless, truly restless engagement with religion. A complex, difficult to grasp, pointing in many directions. We have, for the very first time, an American pope. It seems almost like
it's so
like
cool, isn't it?
I think you mean a Chicago pope.
Chicago pope, who's also black.
Who also recently received a delegation of religious leaders from Chicago.
Right.
And looked really happy about that Sox hat and that Cubs hat.
I think it's very important in this evangelical view of American religion that the Vatican now has one of the 335 million in a very savvy and visionary. This is also a country that in its bills keeps on saying, in God we trust, mentions God, has a big I, not only the I, the letter I, but the big I that looks at us from the dollar bills as a kind of spiritual entity. A country where almost every political figure, probably not the socialist progressives, but otherwise ends a speech or a sermon with God bless America. Even those that don't believe in God end the speech with that. We are constantly throwing in the word God in all kinds of items that reflect or don't reflect. And I personally, Emily, like topics that are this complex, that don't allow themselves to be read easily. And I'm fascinated by that complexity.
Yeah, when the first Puritans arrived on these shores, they explicitly identified it as the New Jerusalem, right? John Winthrop called this the city on the hill, which is the description of Jerusalem. That mentality that a new world order, the final fulfillment of the promise of the Bible would be achieved here in the United States was part of the very fabric of this country before there was any such thing as the United States, and it still very much is. We are a country in which the language of religion holds the most currency. And so we use religious language not just in our politics, and Ilan is right, like even when it's so forced and ridiculous. I mean, we have a president today who is the avatar of the seven deadly sins, and yet he speaks, you know, poorly, you know, in the same religious language. I mean, he can't name a book of the Bible, but you know what I'm saying.
But he can't sell you one.
Yeah, he can sell you one. Exactly. Yeah. But even Obama. I mean, Obama was not a deeply spiritual man, but he knew he had to speak the language of spirituality in order to connect with the masses. George W. Bush didn't describe the post 9/11 world as a complex military intelligence operation against the transnational terror organization. He said, it's a battle between good and evil. And we are all like, I choose good? I mean, those are your two choices? It's just a deep, fundamental part of what it means to be American, whether you yourself are religious or not. It's that language that makes sense, it animates us, it helps us form an identity more than anything else. You know, it helps us answer that very difficult to answer question, which is, what does it mean to be American? What does that even mean? In a country of, you know, a dozen languages and, you know, all these different religions and ethnicities and cultures, well, what does it actually mean to be American? Religion helps to answer that question a little bit. The same Pew poll, this was 2016, so, you know, a decade or so. Maybe it was 2006, so it wasn't even a decade after 9/11. I think it was Gallup did a poll where they discovered that more Americans were likely to vote for a Muslim to be president than for an atheist to be president. This is 5 years after 9/11, right? At a time of profound anti-Islamic sentiment. And so we just have this distrust of people who can't at least even pretend to have a religiosity to them. We think of them as separate or immoral or outside what our identity is. And I do think that it's baked into the very fabric of this country from the very, very start, the way that this country was conceived of and designed was to be the new Jerusalem.
And on that incredibly joyous final note, I should say the book is out at the end of the month. Go buy it, read it, tell folks what you think, and please join me in thanking our two guests. And me.
Thank you for listening to this episode from the American Writers Museum Podcast Network. Be sure to subscribe so you are notified when new episodes are released. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.